All right, good morning, everybody. Open up to the book of Daniel. I can see you guys are nice and awake this morning. Maybe it's because there's no coffee back there. Sorry about that surprise for some of you. Couldn't get the machine working this morning, so I know some of you are a little bit off kilter this morning. Book of Daniel is where we're going to be. Daniel chapter 6 for most of the morning, but we're going to kind of make our way through the first couple of chapters over again where we started, where we left off last week, and kind of remind ourselves of the story just a little bit. We're continuing on in this series, This Is My Story, and the story of God's people all over Scripture and what we can learn from their stories and how it should inform our stories and even shape our stories. These stories in Scripture are there for a reason. They're not just there for history purposes. They're not there for just to be able to explain what happened at this time. They're there to instruct us, to shape us, to mold us, to go before us and give us an idea of how we should live our lives. And so we're in the midst of this series, This Is My Story. And then last week we kind of started a little bit of a mini-series talking about how do you live within a culture that's somehow set against us. And we talked a little bit about politics and election and how much we all hate that right now. And we'll talk a little bit about it next week as well. But this week is going to focus in on one guy. So last week we began and we looked at four guys: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, or as you know them, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, with Daniel. So we looked at those four guys. Daniel kind of goes off on his own track. These three guys kind of get put in this one place, and we have the story of the fiery furnace, and we saw this great example of faith and what it means to trust God in spite of all circumstances last week, and where these guys picked their battles and where they chose to stand tall. And so we saw all these different things, and these guys were taken captive, had to go through what was essentially Babylon University, 3 years of learning everything about Babylon, and not just what they were, not just some education, but basically indoctrination. They were given all the things. They had to learn the language, they had to learn the religion, they had to learn the astrology and all that goes on went into to making this great nation of Babylon. And these guys did it. They went through all of it, but when it came time to give homage to Nebuchadnezzar instead of to God, those guys refused to bow the knee. That was their story. And this morning we get to look at the fourth member of this crew. The fourth member of the crew, Daniel. And what you'll see is that Daniel lived a life that was built around faith to God, that was built around who he was. And that faith, here's what's interesting, the faith that he displayed got him into some very influential places. We're kind of geared to think that our faith will get us in trouble in the larger culture, and eventually it does, and we'll see that here with Daniel, but it also got him into very influential places. It got him into essentially being second command, the right-hand man to the king running the nation. For lack of a better way to say it, he was all the way up there, and that all came from his faith. And what I want us to focus on is how this faith played out in his life, and how our faith should play out in our life as well. Because the reality is, Daniel never ever shied away from that faith, good or bad, no matter where it would put him, no matter what it meant for him, he never shied away. It doesn't take an in-depth, and I thought about this. I thought about talking about this morning, going through all the different things and the way that our culture has shifted, but I don't think it's really necessary. I think we all can sit back and look and know that Christianity is increasingly in the crosshairs of our nation's rage cycle, is the best way that I know how to describe it. Do you know how that works, the cultural rage cycle? The culture will identify something that they think is amiss in our culture, something they think is wrong. Now, this can shift from year to year. In fact, it often does. Things that were okay a year ago are not okay now. Things that were not okay a year ago are celebrated now. So this is constantly shifting, and you never know when you're going to be on the opposite side of this rage cycle that continues to go and go and go. But they pick out something to be outraged about, they tweet about it, they blog incessantly about it, and then they expect everyone to conform to that moment's notion of right and wrong. Now, it's a momentary thing. There's nothing permanent about it. And often how they base that is based simply on how they feel in the moment. There's no long-term consideration. There's no historical consideration of a long ethical standard. It's just what feels right in the moment. And if you don't conform to whatever that momentary opinion is, then you will be publicly shamed. You will be scorned for your backward, ignorant, and bigoted views. And the rage won't end until they have a cultural scalping. And Christianity increasingly finds itself right in the view of this rage machine. And there's all kinds of reasons for this. And I just want to be very frank up front here. Part of the reason that Christians are in the crosshairs for this rage machine is because we've been terrible over the years at picking our battles. Because we pick battles with very little grace, with very little love, with very little understanding of our own sinfulness, and instead have condemned people in such a way that really kind of sets people up to react in such a way that they will come after us. Historically, Christians didn't exactly wield our cultural influence with grace and kindness. In fact, I think if you go back over the history of this nation, especially the last 50 years or so, but really the entire history of this nation, Christians often were bullies within their environment. And so now a lot of what we see is essentially the bullying being switched. No longer do Christians have the majority influence in a lot of places, and now the bullying has switched, and the Christians are the ones being bullied. We can talk about that on all kinds of different ways, whether it's the South and racism, whether that's the political ambitions of the 80s and the 90s and the religious right, or how we show grace to those that we disagree with, like homosexuals, and how they had been treated really up until the last 5 years or so. So Christians have not been spotless. So I don't want to present this, oh, Christians are just great and have done everything well, and now, oh, look at us, the victims. That is not my goal here at all. Now, that's the language that you hear a lot if you watch too many news programs or you sit around and have too many conversations with people that, oh, what have we done? We're just out here trying to do our thing, and now people are coming after us. There's a reason that people are coming after us as Christians. That being said, we have to figure out, how do we live within this culture now? How do we live when we are constantly going to be put in the crosshairs of that rage of the culture? I know the temptation, the easy temptation, is to just go underground. To retreat just a little bit, fall back just a little bit, hunker down, go into our churches, and retreat from the public square. And move away from this kind of dialogue. This isn't the first time that would have happened. There's all kinds of historical examples, but we don't even need to look at history. We can go right to the Gospels. When the Jewish religious elite turned against, and the Romans turned against Jesus, Peter was ready to fight. But when Jesus says, listen, we're not going to fight, we're not going to come out here and do it this way, the next thing that happened is Jesus was led away, and Peter was denying that he even knew Jesus whenever people turned to him. And they said, wait a minute, aren't you one of those guys? And he says, I swear to you, curses at them, says, I'm not that guy. I don't know who you're talking about. Just leave me alone. Peter wanted to go underground. He wanted to get away whenever the gaze turned to him. When he found himself in the same crosshairs that Jesus was in, Peter wanted to get away. So we know just from the biblical testimony that this is a natural temptation for us to just try and hide, to try and pull the hood over, to try to pull the cloak over and just get in a dark corner and say, just come back to me later when all this passes. But the life of Daniel shows us that that's not the best way. The life of Peter shows us that that's not the best way. Instead, what it teaches us is how to engage. The reality is, at some point in the very near future, if you haven't already, you'll have a conversation with someone and they'll say, you don't really believe that, do you? And as soon as you hear that, you're going to know this conversation's not going to go well for me. you're going to say something about what you believe, and they're going to say, you don't really still believe that. That's such a backward thing to believe. That's such a backward and bigoted way to think. That's such an odd way to talk about things. You don't really believe that homosexuality is wrong, do you? You don't really believe that sin is still a thing and that there's a God that you offend. That's like the stuff that we had to grow up with. That stuff we're past that. Or as our politicians like to say, we've evolved beyond that. Those conversations will happen. You'll be presented as hateful, even though there's no hate in your heart. You'll be presented as judgmental and as someone who can't love, even though you feel like what you're saying is the most loving thing that you can think of. And it could be anything. It could be homosexuality, it could be marriage, it could be assisted suicide, it could be the existence of sin. It doesn't matter. There'll always be things that people will be putting us in the crosshairs for. So what do you do then? What do you do at that point? Do you just lay low? Do you attack at that point? Do you turn defensive and go after somebody at that point? What do we do? So Daniel's story will give us an idea of how to proceed. As our story began last week, we saw that Daniel was kind of the ringleader of these four guys, right? Daniel was the ringleader. They were taken captive. They were sent to this Babylon university, and they quickly excelled. They became well known for how good they were, how great they were. They were put in charge of stuff. They were put in the king's court amongst his wisest men, these four guys. And if you look in chapter 2, I'm not going to read anything from there, but it would be good for you to open to Daniel chapter 2, and you can kind of see and just kind of follow around just a little bit. What you'll see is that there's some amazing things that happen that Daniel is a part of here very early, even before he gets through his three years of university. He's there, and the king has some intense dreams. And he knows that there's something important in these dreams, but he can't figure them out for the life of him. So he calls together all of his wisest men, and he says, tell me what's going on here. I need to know what's happening in these dreams. And nobody has a clue. The wisest men, they're magicians, they're all the guys that should be able to help him out, nobody has a clue. So like any irrational egomaniac king, he orders them all to be killed. Makes total sense, right? You guys come help me out. Wait, you don't know? Fine, then you're dead. That makes total sense, but that's how he works. Doesn't make any sense at all, but this is how King Nebuchadnezzar works, which we'll learn a lot more about Nebuchadnezzar next week. That's going to be the story we'll look at next week. But Daniel gets word of this. Daniel and his buddies were set to be killed, even though they hadn't been brought in and specifically asked about this dream. The whole court, the whole group of the wisest men were set to be killed because they couldn't answer this. Daniel gets word of this, and he says, maybe I can be of help here. Maybe I can step in and I can help you out. Hold on just a second. Let's hold the sword for just a minute. Let's not kill these guys. Maybe I can help you out, King. Give me just a minute. Here's what the dream is. I realize this is what it is. He prays and he basically says, God, help me understand what's going on here so that I can respectfully serve the king and so that I can respectfully serve all of my guys around me in the king's court that's about to be killed. God answers the prayer, gives Daniel the interpretation of the dream, and the king is blown away. He's overwhelmed by what he learns, and he promotes Daniel, he pays homage to Daniel, and he pays homage to Daniel's God. This is something we see over and over with Nebuchadnezzar, right? He did it with the fiery furnace, he did it here with Daniel. He pays homage, and it's a fascinating scene to read through and to watch. Daniel legitimately wants to help the king out. He's not just doing this because he's scared, although I'm sure that that's part of it. But legitimately, when you read through the text in chapter 2, he's saying, I really want to help this guy out. This guy is the king. I want to honor him for the position that he holds, and I want to be of service to him. There's a lot that we can learn here. The primary thing that we can see for this is that Daniel acts on behalf of the king. In the best interest of the king. And he does so to show the power of God, but he also does so to show the love for the king. We've got to learn how to apply this as Christians. We've got to be better at how we apply this lesson as Christians. Part of our role in a community, as a church, part of our role has to be to genuinely love and serve and care for that community. Even that community, maybe even especially that part of the community that is set against God, that is warring against God, and that is destroying the community, we have to be people that step in and sincerely care for that community. When one part of our community gets better, we all get better. As they say, the high tide raises all boats. For us, if we can improve a part of our community, all of our community gets better. So what does that look like? What does that mean? How do we do that? We've talked about this a lot as a church. This is what the Love Jeffco stuff is all about. If you've seen the t-shirts, we've got some t-shirts here if you want to get some t-shirts this morning. If you've seen the t-shirts, if you've heard us talk about it, this is what Love Jeffco is all about. That us as a church should be able to speak into the community, should be able to do things in the community that are not necessarily just for us, or really that we may not benefit from at all, but to make the community a better place. And we want to support organizations that have that same kind of mission at heart. So Renovatus and how they're trying to care for people that are coming through a drug addiction and through rehab, Life Outreach Center, where you have the most vulnerable, both in the pregnant young lady and the babies that are there, to be able to care for them. These are the people that are on the front line, so we want to be able to support those ministries. And then as individuals, we want to be able to do that as well. I know we talk about this a lot, but there's a reason we talk about this a lot, because it's massively important. And Daniel's life gives us an idea for that. His attitude is overwhelmingly supportive and full of humility as he addresses the king. Look in verses 36, 37, and 38 of chapter 2. He reads the dream, and as you go through this, and if you read through it, I'm not going to read it. For the sake of time, I'm not going to read it all, but if you read through that right there, those few verses, 36, 37, 38, 39, that little section, what you see is that Daniel doesn't shy away from praising the king at all. And it's clearly giving him the interpretation in order to care for him. Daniel's faith in God and his concern for God's glory led him to show genuine support, genuine concern for the king. And so it is for us. Our love for God and our concern for God's glory should lead us to care for others around us, those both in power over us and those around us that need to know who God is. We must genuinely care for them. Our faith must drive us to engage wherever and whenever we can. So just let's keep moving in this story and see what else we can learn from Daniel's story. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through this story, kind of rapid fire, looking at several different episodes in his life. And then at the end, we're going to come back and we're going to say, so what? So what? Daniel did this, so what? What does that matter for us? And keep following along in his story. And this dream scenario repeats itself two more times. Two more times, Daniel's going to be faced with trying to interpret these dreams and knowing what's going on with these dreams. So we see this repeated over and over. And in both dreams, Daniel says that the dream means that the king is going to lose power, that the king is going to be humbled, and that another person is going to take over this big kingdom. In both instances, they don't believe him. The first one was with Nebuchadnezzar, and then the next one was with a totally different king that had come in. Turns out he's right. Daniel nails the interpretation. I don't know if you want to call this a prophecy or what, but he nails the interpretation in these dreams correctly three different times. And in doing so, he proves himself to be a valuable asset to those that are in charge. And so he keeps getting these promotions over and over and over. He's forgotten for a little bit of a time, but somebody remembers, brings him, and they say, man, this is amazing that you can do this. You're promoted, and then something happens to that king. So move on to chapter 6. I'm not going to read all the they're really cool stories if you want to read them. The handwriting on the wall and all these amazing things that I remember from my time as a kid and thinking this is really weird and wacko. And it really is kind of weird and wacko stuff. But Daniel understands it. He interprets it because God gives him that interpretation. And if you keep following along, you just see this repeat over and over and over. And in chapter 6, where we are there, two kings have kind of passed on now. And now the kingdom's ran by a guy named King Darius. So Nebuchadnezzar's gone, a guy named Belshazzar's gone. Now you have Darius that's running the kingdom. Darius recognizes that Daniel is this massive asset. And he puts Daniel all the way in charge up to being essentially like the prime minister of the kingdom. The king probably didn't have a whole lot to do with the day-to-day operations of the nation and what happened, but Daniel did. So Daniel was running things. He was the right-hand man for the king. He ruled over everything under the king's authority, but he ruled over it all. Now, Daniel's peers were no fan of this at all. This did not make them happy, and so they were extremely jealous, and they basically set out on this plot to see how they can take Daniel down. They set out on this plot, they talk to the king, and they say, "Hey, king, are you sure that this setup is the way that you want to do this?" And they trick the king into signing a law that the king doesn't even recognize it's going to have any real impact at all. It seems pretty innocuous. They're basically going to say, "King, why don't you set this up so that nobody can ask anything of anyone except for you? Nobody can pray to a god. Nobody can go to another ruler or to another king or to another governor or anyone else to ask for help. They're just going to go to you. And if they do go to somebody else, they'd be put to death." Now, this sounds like a really weird law for somebody to propose. But in Darius' situation, it makes a little bit of sense. He's a new king. He's wanting to show his subjects that he can be a good king. He's wanting to prove that he can rule them well. And in order to make them basically come to him and depend on him, make them more dependent on him and give him a chance to prove himself as a good king, he says, "You're not allowed to go anywhere else. No prayers to anyone else, no nothing. You come to me and that will be how you get whatever it is you need." Darius says, this is a good idea, signs the law into action. And what he doesn't realize is as he does that, he implicates Daniel, his right-hand man. Because you see, Daniel regularly prayed 3 times a day that God would help him. We saw this all throughout whenever you go back and read the accounts of the dreams. Daniel would precede that by saying, "God, help me understand this dream. Help me understand what it is that I've been told or what this dream is so that I can tell the king what this is." Daniel relies on God at every stretch. That's just who he is. And so Daniel has been targeted. And Daniel recognizes that there's more to this new law. So this new law is here. And there's all that's going on with this. The king doesn't realize it, but Daniel knows that something is up. And this is where things are interesting to me. Because Daniel knows he's targeted. Daniel knows he's in the crosshairs of these jealous peers that are trying to get him. He knows he's going to be persecuted. He knows it's coming. He knows that people are watching him. He knows all eyes are on him, and he knows he's in a tight spot, and he doesn't change a single thing. He changes nothing after this law goes into effect. Look with me in chapter 6, verse 10. "When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously." He just kept doing the same thing. Even though he was under no obligation to do so, he could have changed some things up. He didn't pitch a fit. He didn't challenge the king. He didn't go yelling about how this is not fair, how you can't do this, how you should stop this. He didn't cry out in panic or fear. He just went about the same thing. He didn't sit around talking to his friends about how the end was near and how this was going to be it and how there was nothing else that could happen. He didn't put up signs in protest. He didn't do any of that. He took it in stride, and he refused to panic. Not only did he not panic, he refused to live in fear. He didn't go home, close the windows, quietly offer up prayer in the dark in hopes that no one would see him. He could have done that, though. There was nothing against that that said, you can't do that. He could have done that. He refused to be bullied, and he refused to cower in fear. I remember when I was a freshman in high school, I felt like I should start praying before my meals. Now, that doesn't sound like maybe a big thing to you, but for me as a freshman in high school, I'd only been Christian for a few months. My family didn't typically pray before meals. That's not something we did. It's not something I did. It just wasn't part of my habit. Just never really happened. But I felt like I should start praying before my meals. Now, just to be clear, when I was a freshman in high school, my meal wasn't much of a meal. I think I had fries every day for lunch. But this was the meal that was in front of me. And I was trying to figure out, what do I do as a Christian now? I was reading my Bible, trying my best to figure out what's supposed to change in my life now that I'm a Christian. What do I do differently? And I had been told very clearly in all my Sunday school classes that you should pray and you should pray before meals. So at lunch, I would try to do this. But I've got to be honest, the first couple of months for me doing this, I was as discreet as I possibly could be, right? Do you know how that prayer works? The discreet prayer that you don't want anyone to notice? Like you kind of pull up to your table and you're like, you scratch your head a little bit, you just put your head down for just a second, and then you look up and you're like, all right, I'm good. I said a little prayer, and the prayer was like, thanks for the food, amen. And then you can just kind of go on and move on, right? You know how that prayer works? I don't know if you've been there and you've done that. I did that for like 6 months. Because I was really like worried what was going to happen. Is somebody going to say something? It's kind of weird that I stop and that my eyes are closed and everybody around me. And it just made me really, really uncomfortable. This was not Daniel. No discreet, quick little prayers for him. Three times a day, right in front of the window, anybody could see that wanted to see. He was hiding nothing. He was faithful before, and he'll be faithful now. And you know the story from here. They see him praying. They tell the king. The king hates it. He hates that he's been tricked into signing this law, but for whatever reason, the king can't change this law because it would make him look like a fool, and so he's just kind of got to let things play out. The king hates that it's happened this way, but a law is a law. Daniel is thrown into the lion's den to be devoured. And read with me in verse 19. Then at the break of day, the king arose and went into haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him, and also before you. O king, I have done no harm. Then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. So that's Daniel's story. That's Daniel's story, one that's well known. One that we've heard and we want to emulate his faith and learn from him, but the question that I've got is, now what do you do with this? So this is a great story. This guy had great faith and lions' mouths were shut. So what do you do with this? Is the application to this, if you just trust God, nothing bad's ever going to happen to you? I think Jesus' life is enough of a testimony to know that that's not true. Because Jesus trusted God and he went all the way to the cross. So then what do you do with this? Where do you go from this? So what? He lived to tell the tale. I think there's four things. There's a lot of takeaways we could take from this, but there's four in light of this idea of this cultural persecution and how we should live in the midst of this that I want us to look at. The first, our gifting is for blessing others, and opening doors. Our gifting is for blessing others and opening doors. God will often use our gifts to give us a way to speak to our culture. Do you ever think about your gifting that way? Or do you think about your gifting as just something that you're kind of good at and you just got to try to figure it out? God will often use our gifts to give us a way to speak to the culture. Daniel's ability to interpret dreams, among his other gifts, clearly he was a good administrator, clearly he was a good leader and worked well in that. So his gifts that he were given were a tremendous asset. And it led others to seek him out for his advice and for his interpretation. It led him to get promoted and to be put into some very powerful, powerful places. God's gifting was what was given to him that became the key to get there. Our gifts are not given so that we can impress others or so that we can be proud of ourselves or have good self-esteem. Our gifts have been given to us so that we can help those around us, both within the church and outside the church. Some of you guys in here are tremendous businessmen. I know as I talk to you and I hear about your gifting and the things that you do and how you help others and how you work through things and how you've built these businesses, I'm blown away by it. Your gifting as a businessman and your ability to do those things should be done to bless those around you and to bless the community around you. I didn't tell him I was going to do this, but I think Spencer's heart is a great example of this. Spencer owns the Creek. He's built the Creek into a good business. He's an entrepreneur, takes all kinds of risks that every time that he would tell me, hey, I did this and hey, I did that, I'd be like, you make my heart hurt just hearing the different things that you do. I'm not a risk taker. That's not natural for me to be able to do that. But Spencer did that. And when I talked to him, I remember talking to him like 5 years ago. And I said, so why are you doing this? What is it that you think you're going to get out of this? He said, you know, I want to make money. I want to be able to, you know, at least make sure that I'm not losing money on this thing. But really one of the main things that I want to do is I want to start something in Jefferson City that Jefferson City can be proud of. That's something good for our community. That's why the Creek exists. That's a beautiful picture of how you take your gifting that you've been giving and you serve, or that you've been given, and you serve others with it. Some of you are amazing encouragers. Use that to care for others. We could go through all kinds of different giftings. Figure out how what you do can help others, both within the church and outside the church. Live your life the way Daniel did, looking to bless others and to care for others. The second takeaway from Daniel's life that we can see is that standing for truth will always be countercultural. Standing for truth will always be countercultural. Daniel's time that he's living in is massively different from ours on a million different levels. But in some ways, it's exactly the same. Because sin and human nature has not changed. Political realities can change. Political systems can change. The goal of nations can change. The location can change. Technology can change. But sin stays the same, and so does human nature. For Daniel to take this stand and to not run and hide, he knew was going to end badly for him. And it took tremendous faith. He knew he would have to stand alone, to face down his critics, and that they would be coming after him. As Christians, we too often make a mistake of assuming that if we can just elect the right people, get the right people in charge to put in place the right laws, then standing for truth would then somehow become easy. And that the only reason that standing up for what's right is because we've got the wrong people in charge. Now, don't get me wrong. We live in a democracy that Daniel did not, so we should use that power that we have of the vote to put the right people in the right places that can help and protect Christians. So that's good for us to do. But when you begin to trust those politicians and those elected leaders to be the one to make your life better and to help you avoid persecution and to help you avoid that, you are chasing after a ghost that you will never find. standing for God will always be countercultural. Always. That will never change. Being a Christian has never been easy, and we're fools if we would expect it to be at any point in our lives. If we want to stand for what's right, we have to be prepared for the persecution that is bound to follow. And that's point number three. Point number three, persecution is absolutely normal. This flows right out of the second one. Persecution is normal. If you read through the Bible any extent at all, you will see that at every turn, God's people are met with resistance. Old Testament, New Testament. We see it here in Daniel. You turn to 1 Peter, and it says, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you." I love the language that he uses there. Like, why are you surprised? Like, this is something that you shouldn't expect. You should know this is going to happen to you. Persecution as Christians is normal. We'll talk a lot about that here in a couple of weeks. But notice when the trial does come that Daniel's not screaming from the rooftops about injustice. He's not panicked. He's not terrified. He simply takes what is happening to him in stride. Now, there's a place to fight for injustice, so I'm not saying that's not what we do. Absolutely, we should do that. But for way too many Christians, playing the victim has become our favorite pastime. Playing the victim, woe is me, oh, it's so hard to do this, it's so hard to be a Christian. We love to just say that and live in that kind of victim mentality. I've been around way too many Christians that flat out enjoy sitting at a table and talking about how bad we have it. We cannot just play the victim. You ever sit at a table and just sit there and heard that over and over and over about how awful things are, and the conversation never gets beyond that? It's good to talk about persecution. It's good to know when it's happening and to get that word out there, but you have to get beyond that. And can I just be honest? Those that like to play the victim, most of the time, whenever I listen to the stories that they have to say, I end up saying, wait a minute, what's the problem? And half the time, I'll end up agreeing with the opposite party. You know what I'm talking about? Like, you know, the other day I was in Lifeway and I was just looking through their stuff and I was looking at their VBS material and I noticed that they had this one set of VBS stuff that didn't have King James Version text in it. And I can't believe that they would do something like this. So I took all of them and I threw their stuff in the trash and they threatened to call the police on me. Can you believe that they would do something like that? Like, that's the level of persecution that I hear people talk about all the time. And I'm sitting there thinking, you should have got the police called on you. Like, that's what should have happened. That's not persecution. That's you being an idiot and a jerk, right? You've got to know the difference between the two. Between persecution for being faithful and between people just calling you out for being what you are. Those are not the same. Daniel wasn't a jerk to anybody. As best we can tell, he voiced no opposition at any point. He simply followed God, prayed to God, and then had to deal with the consequences. Don't play the victim. Play the faithful, righteous, humble servant of God. That is our role in a culture that is set against us. And then finally, the fourth, and maybe it sounds cliche, but our trust is fully in God. We'll talk a lot more about this next week. Maybe this will be a little bit of a lead-in to next week. But notice that Daniel's confidence did not lie in his own ability to defeat the lions. He wasn't convinced that the lions were going to be beat. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not convinced that the fire would not consume them. They simply trusted God and said, God will do what God needs to do, and I'll trust him with what's about to happen. His faith in God drove everything for him. Sometimes our faith in God leads us to be protected and leads us through the fire and through the lion's den. And sometimes our faith in God and our trust in him will lead us to the cross. It's the same God that we trust. And it's the same result in the end that we seek, the glory of God. When Daniel was spared from the lions, God was glorified. And when Jesus was hung on the cross, God was glorified. And this is the beauty of the story. Because we can read through this and we can see Daniel's faith and we can say, I can never do that. I'd be crying like a baby. I'd be pitching a fit. I'd be yelling and I'd be screaming. And I would be faithless in that moment. But the beauty is because Jesus was faithful. The better Daniel, the better Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, the one that went to the cross, that wasn't delivered, that wasn't spared. Because he was faithful, we can trust in his faith. And our faith is put in him, not in ourselves, not in our own faith. So let me ask you this question this morning. Where does your faith lie today? Or for tomorrow? When you watch the election that's happening, when you spend 3 minutes on Fox News or CNN, where do you have faith? What keeps you from panicking or quitting or just giving up? Where do you have your faith? Faith isn't just some nebulous idea that you hope for great things to happen one day and that things will eventually get better. That's not faith. Faith is an unwielding confidence in the one that you serve, that he's there with you in the fire, in the lion's den, and on the way to the cross. So do you have a faith like Daniel, trusting in God? That's where all of this starts. And us as Christians, this is how we go forward. We don't play the victim. We don't run in fear. We don't hide in the shadows. We don't avoid hard conversations. We stay faithful. And we follow after God. Will you pray with me? Father, thank you this morning for the story of Daniel. For a life that teaches us what it means to live in the midst of persecution. That teaches us what it means to follow after you when it could cost us everything. Father, help us to learn from this example of how we face that down. Father, we confess that this is not easy. It's not a simple task. That our hearts fill with fear for ourselves and for our children. That we want to fight and we want to do it in a way that honors you. And Father, give us wisdom on where we fight, where we humbly submit. Know the difference in the two. Father, just help us not to live in fear, but to live in boldness and faith in you. It's in Christ's name we pray. Amen.